several times in your writing, you talk about the way how important it is for that black presence in Britain to, or there to be understandings and representations that are recognisable, that in some ways make sense of that conjuncture, of that predicament, if you like, of those.
I think that's very important, and in some ways it's because, if you move towards, if your analysis move towards the level of the conjunctural, you have to take a much wider range of phenomena into account. You can't just rest with the underlying logic. And so you're, you think about what is likely to awaken identification.
There's
no party without identification. People have to invest something of them in something that they recognize is of them or speaks to their condition. And without that moment of recognition, politics also has a drift. So politics will go on, but you won't have a political movement without that moment of identification. So of course it matters to me profoundly, what strikes the popular imaginary, what strikes that, what is not necessarily a political theory or political doctrine, but what appeals to the imaginary, and in the imaginary unlocks something which isn't usually unlocked elsewhere. I once said about popular culture, which is, I've been an aficionado from ever since, and still am. I must be the only middle-class viewer of Neighbours left on earth. So I'm still addicted to parts of popular culture. But I said once about it, it's only what is at stake in the popular that makes it worthwhile. Otherwise, who gives a shit about it? Otherwise, it's of no... it's not of any importance. And also, it's just an inventory. This is popular culture, that is high culture. Now, here's a bit of popular culture moving into, who cares about that? What matters is where the popular imaginary gets itself expressed, and where, and it does not always get expressed in high culture. It gets expressed in the dirty, compromised, commercialized, overridden world of popular culture. Which is never an uncontradictory space, never an uncontested space, the popular. So one must attend to it.
No, but I guess as well, there's no sense of what popular culture is in this context without a black presence.
Oh no, of course.
It's impossible to think it now.
Of course, that is so, and it's so politically. That's why I said today, I would say, class has lived through the modality of race, in the same way as race has lived through the modality of class. That's what has happened. But it is, that is true of any kind of politics you can think of. But even if you didn't, the signs of the black presence are all around us. So there isn't a, there may be less of a black presence movement. There's less an affirmation of black consciousness. But it's there. How could you look at popular culture, popular life? How could you look at the cities? How could you look at football? How could you look at popular music? How could you look at any of those spheres? How could you look at the NHS?
Indeed.
Well, this for goodness sake, I go to dialysis 3 times a week. It's like a cross section of multicultural drift. If you want to see multicultural drift, come with me, on a Thursday to the dialysis unit of St. Charles Hospital. You will see it. You will see it, I tell you.
Oh, yes. Oh, it's very live in my mind too, Stuart, for all kinds of other reasons, which are not important for us to talk about now. But exactly, the hospital
as a
place to think.
The hospital, absolutely.
Of those.
I do love my thinking there, I tell you. So, what sustains the black presence? Well, it's sustained in all sorts of ways. And there's no reason to give up hope because it's not at the high political pitch that it was in the 80s, not at the high level of political consciousness. The problem, is really not so much going back to that, but trying to imagine what that might be in the next decade, in the next conjuncture.
Sure.
Yeah? How will these informal presences, which are so important, come together in another moment to create another kind of black or whatever multicultural politics? We don't have a moment to imagine that yet. I mean, we don't have the capacity to imagine that yet. But still, that is the question.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a good question.
So, you know, the sustainers of that black presence and what is happening in them, including a lot of contradictory things, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, what is happening to black young people, young boys especially, is completely horrendous. Completely horrendous. And I have to confess to you that one of the reasons for it, or one of the things which contains it, is precisely black popular culture. As an aficionado of black popular culture, you know, it gives me the deep pain to have to say it, but it does say it. It gives young black people another world of recognition, which they're not going to find in the everyday world. They're not going to find through academic success. They're not going to find through... Some of them have, of course. That's one of the things that's happened in multiculturalism. Yeah? Some people have made it. Some black people make it much more than they ever have before. And some by dint of very hard work. For instance, a lot of women at the bottom of the social work and medical professions, etc., have studied, brought up their children on their own. You know, they have really lived a heroic life in this period. But not everybody can do that. And an alternative has been offered to them in certain aspects of, you know, what we used to be quite romantic about, drop out. Yeah, that's okay. But lives are being lost. Lives are being sacrificed.
Indeed. I mean, there's no easy way to speak about that, is there?
It's almost, I find it almost impossible to speak about.
But at the same time,
the terrain of the dialogue is so, you know, horrendously skewed that one can hardly talk about it at all. But I mourn it every day.
Indeed. I mean, I think of it in those spaces that I'm close to, and people that I'm close to as well, of those young lives damaging themselves, actually damaging people
damaging
who are the mirror image of
themselves. And damaging other people just like them.
I wanted to ask you about our kind of to Andrew's really, because we've talked for a long time about our current conjuncture. I suppose there's been an awful lot of talk about the death of multiculture and death of multiculturalism. And when do you think this isn't a lovely question really, but I mean, do you think that our current conjuncture begins, as so many say, with, you know, September 11th stuff, or do you think that is a beginning of something, of the a beginning of the now, say, or is, have you got another sense of where we are at this point?
In pure conjunctural terms, but this is, you know, it's just speculation. I think the present conjuncture begins in the mid 70s. The Thatcherism was the first installment of it. It's really about globalization. So, you know, all the things to do with this world and that world, with the other here, with asylum, with waves of migration, with people thrown out of their homes, with, you know, people living in transit camps, all of that stuff is the underside of globalization, in my view. Globalization is how capital saved itself from the welfare state. Once it realized it couldn't directly roll back the welfare state, it had to go somewhere else to increase its capacity to exploit labor, and abroad was where it went. You know, overseas growth, the division of labor between the office in Manhattan and the dollar a day worker in Indonesia, you know, etc. Okay, you know, and I happen to think that that this phase of Muslim extremism, or really of the politicization of Islam, is part of that phenomenon too. which is, you know, not to say it doesn't have religious roots, and not to say it doesn't, it takes another step up at the moment of the suicide bomber and terrorism and all that. On the other hand, it takes a step right backwards in terms of occupying other people's countries.
Yes.
Which is so old and ancient that apparently the Brits and the Americans don't even recognize it. They don't see why they're seen in that way.
No.
You know, they can't imagine why they're seen in that way. They came to save them. This is, you know, this is the oldest imperialist story there ever has been. We're here, you know, for the white man's burden.
Mm.
But still, I think it has a lot to do with that. You know, I think about Islam.
Mm.
I think about the possibility of Islamic nationalism.
Mm.
I think about the moment of Islamic socialism.
Mm.
Yeah, you know, all of them exhausted, one after another, in the Cold War and in the period after that. What is left as a way of identifying yourself? But religion. Unfortunately, this is a move to the regressive side of the political spectrum.
Yeah.
But it's performing a lot of the same functions as these other movements performed at an earlier stage.
Yeah.
So, and I happen to think that, you know, we say it's really, you know, being driven by young people on the street. Why are they as poor as they are? Why do they feel hemmed in by, you know, by so many constraints? Why is it that they can't recognize themselves in the modern world? Well, because of the way in which the division of labor in global capitalist society does, you know, make them the objects rather than the subjects of economic development.
Yeah.
So I think there are these underlying things. Yeah, that's why I hesitate to say 9/11 came out of the blue.
Yeah.
We don't know where it came from.
Yeah.
You know, suddenly everything has changed. You can recognize in that my way of simplifying it, all the things I wouldn't like. Yeah? Didn't come out of the blue.
No,
been
sure.
on the history books since there. Yeah. We only left Iraq in 1992 when we were driven out. You know, 1892 when we were driven out. You know, it's not very long ago since we were there.
No.
And so on. You know, we signed the. We colluded in the formation of a religiously exclusive state in Palestine at the expense of driving Palestinians into camps around about. Nothing is from in the Middle East is from the day before yesterday.
No.
Nothing.
No, no.
Of course, that's not to say it remains the same.
No.
This is a new phase,
yeah.
and it's a phase particularly for people on the left because of religion, the ambiguous situation of religion, because we've never understood religion, and because our secular sociological selves thought it was going to go away.
Exactly.
You know, and because, you know, communism and the socialist movements were all secular movements, etc. So culture has taken its revenge on our failure to understand history. So, of course, I, you know, in one sort of way, I feel, well, we'll never be the same again. And I think we may never be. But I wouldn't myself identify the conjunctural shift there.
Yeah, no, good.
Yeah? I identify it as another place.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose in a way, identifying it there enables an easy forgetting or erasure of what's going on.
Yes, I think that involves precisely that. Yeah? And I think it involves America precisely for, you know, to absolve themselves of a long historical responsibility, which has been going on since the beginning of the 19th century.
Yeah, absolutely.
20th century.
Yeah. Just a couple of things to end with, really. And the first one is about the way you periodise the conjuncture of Thatcherism. And you've said many times that New Labour has been a historic missed opportunity.
I think it's a missed opportunity, yes, but it is the second phase of Thatcherism, really. really, that's what it is. You know? So it's a missed opportunity only because it would have had to do something just as dramatic as Thatcherism to have found a counter-politics. Yeah? And that's what, you know, those of us on the left kept saying. You aren't going back to the nationalisation of everything inside. You aren't going back to the old style labour movement. It is being, you know, decentred and distributed around the world by global capitalism. You know, the way is not to go back. The way is to go forward, and it is to try to redefine what your hopes were of that form of liberation. mm. and of that kind of equality mm. in the new conditions.
Yes.
That requires a lot of hard thought, not sentimentality.
Yeah.
And the thought never happened. The thought was, how do we accommodate this?
Yes.
Yeah? Yeah. That's what Giddens taught them. Globalization is irreversible. What can you can do is accommodate to it. Improve the supply side, build up the skills, make Britain more competitive, you know, open the doorway to trade, lower the barriers to invest, you know, etc. Mm-hmm. Make mm-hmm. globalization work.
Mm-hmm.
And the surprise to me is, of course, that social democracy has been more successful than that. And Thatcherism was. Because it attends to the poor, you know, it attends to those who are residually left out, you know, it doesn't want to dismantle it. Whereas Thatcherism drove, you know,
yeah.
it didn't give a damn about anybody, it was just driving this through the society, etc. And the end of Thatcherism is really an interesting moment for me, because nobody quite explained why it happened.
Yeah.
You know, the Conservatives didn't, you know, they adore her.
Yes.
They think she's the most wonderful leader they've had since Churchill.
Yes. So
why did they get rid of her? You know, there's some sense that you can't do this just like that, that the costs, are,
yeah.
that what's falling apart is a consequence of this, you know.
Yeah.
So they sort of move more to the middle terrain. Okay, you know, a bit of, you know, good governance,
yeah, yeah.
etc. So I see, you know, it's not just swearing.
Mm.
You know? If you are talking about a long-term political project, essentially the neoliberal global capitalist project, New Labour, is a more successful installment of it than the first installment, which is Thatcherism.
Yeah, yeah.
And as you know, I wrote a lot about Thatcherism.
Mm.
Much of it was to try to persuade the left to take it seriously.
Yes,
it's
indeed.
Not just a turn of the electoral screw, etc. It's much deeper movements going on in there. Catch fire.
Mm.
But actually, some people heard it.
Absolutely.
The wrong side heard it.
Yes.
The Blairites heard it and thought, oh yes, this is inevitable. We've got to adapt it.
Yes.
But what I was going to say was that I was preoccupied with the impact of that on Britain.
Mm.
I saw the sort of relationship to Reaganism broadly.
Mm.
I didn't see its global impact. It was a global moment, not a national moment.
Mm-hmm.
It paraded under the nationalist guise, you know, British values, you know, the flag for the Falklands, you know, send the gunboat, etc. But that's just, you know, Marx's notion that the future comes masqueraded like the past. It was a masquerade.
Mm-hmm.
You know? What is happening underneath is much deeper, more transformative.
Very last thing, Stuart. I know that you've used on occasion the idea from Althusser of the importance of bending the twig.
Yep.
Bending the twig. And I suppose some of the ideas that you've helped to shape some of the debates here have had their successes, and people have rested on them. I think you know about the new ethnicities in science and some of those kinds of ideas where people miss the conjunctural.
Yes.
Often, I think. I just wondered how you think we need to bend the twig now in terms of what you've described. What the questions, which way, what kind of things do we need to bend the twig towards and away from? You've mentioned religion and a number of other things. It's just an impossible question to answer.
No, I mean, I'm just, you know, I think, I mean, if I were more certain, I would have written more about it. This is a very tentative answer. And it will reveal how, you know, old-fashioned I am. We need to bend the twig in the direction of understanding the full outcome of the new phase of global capitalism. And that is about difference. It's about, you know, why the question of difference is so, you know, so much on the table. It's why religion has made a return. It's why, you know, half the world feels as if it's, well, half the world has become the proletariat of the other half. You know, it's why so many people are left out. It's why Africa is in such a terrible, disastrous state. You know, on and on and on. So that is not enough. You know, lots of things follow on from that. But if you ask me in terms of how I would intervene in any discussion going on, I'll intervene to remind them of the global dimensions of what is going on. So whereas 20 years ago I would intervene in relation to questions of blackness in terms of race, I would intervene now, not forgetting race at all, but intervene in the direction of questions of difference.
Because it seems like, in the one sense, you know, that where that intervention, it obviously is or points us towards what's happening at the, you know, they're kind of the border questions, where which just seems to be, to in a sense, to be like a kind of a nightmare that's happening to our, you know, there are the things that I care about in terms of Britishness and the way it's shifted and some of the domestic shifts around race and racism, which I think are, you know, I wouldn't say proud of, but I think are something to care about. But the hardening of the border and the keeping of those people, the open hand being shown those people, seem to speak to something.
You're pointing to us. You know, you asked me earlier on, and I didn't reply to you, whether I think that's what's going on, and I do. I think the so-called declared death of multiculturalism is a route back to assimilationism. And assimilationism is a new way of dealing with difference, because it doesn't say you can't be hair. That is sold. It might say only some of you can be here, or not too many of you can be here. And that's what we're going to see. Okay? It can't say none of you, but it says if you're here, you must look and behave like us. You must, in other words, liquidate all those differences that, you know, meant anything to you. Erase them. And become like us. And if you become deeply black English, you know, some of you can stay. That's a new accommodation. It's not quite the Powell moment. Well, I guess they did think they could send us all home. You know, the agents of global capitalism didn't understand that global capitalism was not going to send anybody, you know, home. They wanted to play, you know, I would go into that. But you know what I'm saying.
Of course.
So, I do think that questions of, I do think that the crises that appear now appear in very different forms. You talked about the closure of the border, okay? I'm transfixed by people displaced from their homes. You know, thousands and thousands, millions of people across the world who are living in transit camps or in, you know, UNICEF camps, or, you know, who are the objects of humanitarian aid, who are being fed from the air, you know. This is Agamben's bare life, you know. This is people who, you know, this is a way in which the system has simply ground half of civilized life, you know, into nothingness, into just, it's relying on its bare bones, on its flesh, on its body, and nothing more to give, you know. People, you know, stowing away on the undercarriages of aeroplanes to get out of it, you know, going in leaky boats, you know, where they know they probably won't arrive. You know, boats are already leaking before they leave, but they so must leave the horrors that they are now obliged to live in. You know, I don't recognize this world in the way in which most people describe it at all. I know perfectly well that at the other end, you know, somebody said today, houses, you know, two apartment flats in Mayfair can go for £4 million. I know that. Of course, markets have always done that. Always created the very rich and the very poor. But global capitalism at the moment creates so many of the deeply immiserated people and societies. And so, some of that will surface in terms of black people. I mean, in terms of Africa, the people we're talking about are black. But in the Middle East, the people are brown. You know? And in China, there's something, you know, I know what they are in China. China is a complete mystery. But you understand what I'm saying?
Of course, yeah.
Race alone won't carve that difference, that line any longer.
Yeah.
You have to, you know, expand it in some way to see how difference plays into the way in which rich and poor now have to negotiate a common space, a common life.